From Impact Alpha, welcome to This Week in Impact, where we take you inside the world of sustainable finance and the agents of impact who are working towards a better future. I'm Brian Walsh. It's Thursday, March 21st. Helping me break down this week's impact news and insights is Impact Alpha's founder and CEO, David Bank. We'll be discussing how Texas's campaign against ESG is costing its taxpayers, how investors are using carbon credits to accelerate clean cooking in Africa, and we'll dig into how the climate activist group, the Yes Men, have turned their attention to Vanguard, the world's largest investor in fossil fuels, with a fake campaign to mitigate client and employee concerns about profiting off of climate change. All that and more on This Week in Impact. Hi, everyone. I'm joined by Impact Alpha's top dog, the one and only David Bank. Hi, David. How are you?
Hey, Brian. I'm great. It's great to be here.
Great to have the podcast relaunched. This is our first episode of this new format. Excited to dig into the week's news and issues with you each and every week. And I know this was a busy week for you. Tell me about it.
Yeah, we had one of our Agents of Impact calls. It was actually the 60th, and it was on the Great Deployment, as we're calling it, a new section called Deploy. And it's basically about rolling out climate infrastructure, and in particular, community climate infrastructure. So we had folks from Cleveland and New Orleans and down in Florida. The excitement is around something called the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, which the EPA is about to award, comes out of the Inflation Reduction Act, and it's going to finance a lot of this local, you know, charging stations and solar farms and energy retrofits and all kinds of green infrastructure that that communities can use both to, you know, improve quality of life and then obviously cut carbon emissions as well.
It's very exciting. Now, I understand the call is already up on Impact Alpha's YouTube page, but where can folks learn more about the call?
Yeah, we have a summary of the call, the usual roundup, and then obviously the video is embedded, so folks can get all of that at impactalpha.com. Thanks for asking.
Great. Well, now, David, this week, Andrea Riccardi reported about yet another study that shows how Texas's anti-ESG campaign is costing the state hundreds of millions of dollars. As part of the broader political backlash against ESG and the so-called woke agenda, Texas is among many states that have enacted a ban on doing business with banks and asset managers that consider risks from environmental, social, and governance issues, or ESG. Now, this past Tuesday, Texas officials rescinded BlackRock's financial management of $8.5 billion in state assets, citing the Texas law that prohibits state investments in companies that, quote, boycott energy companies, and due to BlackRock's alleged, quote, dominant and persistent leadership in the ESG movement. Now, David, what is going on in Texas, and why are Texas's political interventions in the capital markets costing the state money?
Well, it's ironic, to say the least, as you say, Brian. Because for starters, you know, yes, they took action against BlackRock. BlackRock has taken hits from other states that have these kind of bans, as you say, on state money being invested or deployed, managed by asset managers that have certain kinds of policies. In particular, it seems, and in Texas's case, certainly seems to be a function of perceived opposition to fossil fuel investments. The irony is that the climate activists are all over BlackRock on the other side for their extensive fossil fuel investments. And here Texas is taking them to task for supposedly being in favor of a boycott of a fossil fuel. So leaving aside that confusion, you have a second level of confusion, which is, you know, a free enterprise, you know, presumably laissez-faire approach that Texas loves to tout is now getting government involved in private market level kind of investment decisions and telling their managers, you know, what they can and can't pay attention to in terms of, you know, fiduciary duties, in terms of material risks and other things. So so you have a bunch of ironies. The third level of irony, I suppose, is that this study that you mentioned was commissioned by an association of local chambers of commerce. So the pro-business folks, you know, all around Texas. And they found that this ban was costing not just, you know, the direct costs, which are like higher fees from finding different underwriters for bonds and managing assets, but literally lost, you know, economic activity. I think something like $669 million in lost economic activity, $181 million in lost annual earnings on interest, you know, a hit of 3,000 jobs and a hit of $37 million in losses to state and local tax revenues. So this is, you know, kind of, you know, in biting your nose to spite your face at the very least.
Now, yeah, that's right. And as Andrea reported, too, that these anti-ESG efforts are having a ripple effect, not just on the economy, but also on regional banks and municipal financing. Can you kind of walk us through that?
Well, you know, the banks and the asset managers, slightly different cases, you know, in different states, and the rules are different in different states. I think something like 20 states have these kind of laws, and they have, you know, resulted in the loss of assets under management for a outfit like BlackRock. You know, the loss of a few billion or even a few tens of billions is kind of a rounding error. And I think they're, I might not have this right, but I think it's up to like $9 trillion in assets under management. And so that's not really going to change BlackRock's behavior, but there is kind of a broader a backlash underway, and it is having some second order effects. A bunch of firms, including BlackRock, but also State Street, JP Morgan Asset Management, PIMCO, dropped out of something called the Climate Action 100 Plus Network, which was advocating for the big climate emitters, the big companies that are big emitters of carbon, to you know, to put forward plans to reduce all that. And they've been under attack from not just states, but also the House Judiciary Committee, which has sent a bunch of subpoenas around recently, claiming that all of that kind of climate action collaboration was an antitrust violation. So there's the other place where the chill is being seen is in the kind of shareholder proposals that come up for a vote, and the whole annual general meeting season is about to get underway, and there'll be climate proposals on a bunch of at a bunch of companies, and the big asset managers again have generally started to shy away from supporting those kind of things for fear of just the kind of thing that's happening in Texas. So when these guys get run out of town, then, you know, smaller banks step into the breach, but often they don't have as big a reach in kind of underwriting these kind of issues. So there's maybe the demand, you know, reflects that, and the cost of capital to cities and states goes up, and in some cases their fees go up. So all in all, it seems like an uneconomic kind of decision for states like Texas.
And as the authors of the report noted, in simple terms, when the government attempts to mandate values, no matter what kind, to business, the market loses and taxpayers bear the consequences.
Well, yeah, as I said, the irony is that the ESG folks are on the side of let business do business, and the free market laissez-faire, you know, mostly Republican politicians are on the side of let's have, you know, political intervention into the market system. So it's a topsy-turvy world, Brian.
Yeah, through the looking glass, indeed. Well, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll discuss how voluntary carbon markets are helping to make the business models of clean cooking companies in Africa more sustainable. All right, now, David, Jessica Pothering reported this week that nearly 2 billion people worldwide, a quarter of the world's population, rely on crude, dirty fuels like firewood, charcoal, and kerosene for home cooking and heating. Now, in forest-dense countries like Rwanda, Burundi, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, charcoal and firewood production is a leading cause of deforestation. But beyond that, smoke exposure from burning such fuels contributes to more than 3 million premature deaths each year, primarily for women and children. Now, entrepreneurs and impact investors have long sought to tackle this challenge through new affordable cooking technologies. Early attempts at so-called clean cook stoves didn't gain traction with customers or investors, so companies are now reframing the issue as focusing on better cooking fuel sources rather than the stoves themselves. So can you talk us through these new cooking technologies, whether it's ethanol, biogas, or liquefied petroleum gas, are really helping?
Well, like you say, there's been a sort of a rebranding of what had been clean cook stoves for many years, and now it's clean cooking. So it's the function of cooking and preparing your family's meals, and less so the cook stoves themselves. And as you say, there has been a switch, the sort of more efficient biomass. So, you know, there were different ways that you could try to save the forest. People would go out and collect firewood, and that was bad. For the forests, obviously, but then, you know, people had various kinds of charcoal solutions that were supposed to be more efficient, and other, you know, being able to burn other kinds of biomass other than wood. And it turns out those did not do a whole lot to reduce this indoor air pollution question that you raised. And so they've kind of fallen by the wayside, and folks are going to, you know, liquefied petroleum gas, kind of, you know, the sort of propane tanks that you know, as a sort of, I guess, interim solution. There are some electric stoves, and there's, you know, induction stoves and other things, but that raises the other question. A lot of places don't have electricity, whereas there is an infrastructure for distributing these tanks of propane, essentially. What I found interesting in Jessica's story is that the carbon savings, people say, you know, oh, isn't that another fossil fuel? And of course it is. But the carbon savings from switching from charcoal to LPG is more than switching your lighting from kerosene lanterns to solar lanterns. So a lot of the focus on kind of energy access in the emerging markets, developing world, has been, you know, solar lanterns. But if you want to just talk about it on a pure carbon basis, get folks off of charcoal for cooking.
Yeah, let's go after the dirtiest fuels first, I guess, is that approach. Now, how does this intersect with the voluntary carbon markets? That's, you know, where you have companies who would maybe voluntarily pay for the carbon they produce because they're not able to reduce it themselves to meet their own net zero goals. How do the cook stoves and clean cooking fuels interact with that market?
There's two kinds of carbon markets. There's the so-called compliance or mandatory markets, which are in California and Europe and a number of other countries now. And they are much larger. So that is most of the world's, you know, what people talk about carbon markets and offsets and things. But there is a voluntary market. So companies that have, you know, whether you call it marketing or PR goals, or, you know, legit interest in being, you know, net zero, do buy credits on the open market. And there's a sort of, you know, several multi-billion dollar market now selling these things, and different qualities of carbon credits fetch different prices. And there's been a lot of criticism and investigations in recent years about the quality of these carbon credits and how much carbon really is being saved over what period of time, how long those benefits last for. Cook stove or cooking, as I said, carbon credits now amount to about 15% of this total supply there. So it's become a big part of the voluntary carbon market, and thus subject to all those same kind of critiques. What Jessica's story point that it made, which I thought was interesting, was it, you know, carbon credits in general may be an imperfect way to reduce carbon in the world. For starters, by buying a carbon credit, you're essentially buying the ability to continue emitting a ton of carbon on the other side. So even at the best of cases, it's sort of a wash. And more to the point, if those carbon credits aren't high quality, then you're not even getting the offset. And so as a carbon accounting mechanism, you might think this is a little bit dodgy, and it probably is. But what her story pointed out is that as a transfer or effectively subsidy to, you know, low-income folks in parts of the world that need clean cooking, not just for the carbon reduction, but for the indoor air pollution and being able to prepare their family's meals on a sort of economic basis, that it's an excellent form of wealth transfer from global corporations to small villagers. And so even if it's not perfect as a carbon accounting mechanism, it's a good way to defray the cost of transitioning from dirty fuels and unhealthy fuels to cleaner and healthier fuels for families, mostly in Africa, other parts of the world as well.
So whereas, you know, we have this great transition that is underway, and in more developed, wealthy countries, governments themselves are helping to subsidize consumers making the transition from dirty to cleaner fuel sources and you know, electric vehicles and the like. And what you're saying that with this cooking technology business model is it's using the carbon credits to finance that transition.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, people, you know, subsidies always kind of a dirty word, but people should be really aware of all the subsidies that are embedded not just the direct ones, like you said, you know, in the U.S. and in other places to help people move to EVs or to solar panels, but all the subsidies in the fossil fuel market, you know, that from the get-go that helped make that whole business work. So the fact that global corporations are paying a little bit, getting some PR value, as I mentioned, but mostly helping folks actually defray the upfront costs of these things, doesn't seem to me like a bad equation. And the long-term costs are lower, so people are saving money on their weekly or monthly fuel costs, which are quite a big chunk of family budgets. And so the question is, how do you knock down the cost of the original, you know, equipment, and then people are ahead, and the subsidies are not needed anymore. So it's a complicated, a little bit wonky, and somewhat contradictory marketplace, but it does seem to be emerging and working and having some good effect.
So David, as you continue to cover this market over time at Impact Alpha, what are you going to be looking for in the future to see about the viability of these business models?
Well, for starters, I mean, there's a number of companies that are moving in on this, and they're rolling it out. There's Coco and Burn in Kenya. We've been following Beebox in Central Africa for many years as a solar company. They've moved, as I said, into cooking because their analysis is that you can save more carbon by focusing on cooking even than on lighting, and so. That's an indication right there. I will say that it's important that these models and these cook stoves, you know, function probably without the carbon markets. The voluntary markets are historically, you know, and famously kind of volatile in terms of the prices going up and down. And as I said, there is a fair amount of critique of the quality of these cooking credits as a carbon reduction strategy. So if that critique holds and the value of those credits falls, then obviously the subsidy falls and then the end user price goes up. So, but you know, again, as all of these things, as these things go to scale, prices come down, markets get more efficient. There's other ways to finance things. So, you know, I think that the carbon credits right now are a nice kind of accelerator, but not necessarily the essential in the long run.
Yeah, we'll have to see if these are training wheels or whether these companies can stand on their own from a sustainability perspective. All right. Well, we'll take a quick break. And when we come back, our final segment, we'll look at how an activist group is turning their sights on Vanguard.
Welcome to the Many Happy Returns Climate Adaptation Hotline by Vanguard. If you are feeling overwhelmed by the effects of climate change, you're not alone. Sometimes our investments can impact the climate in ways we don't prefer, and that makes bad feelings happen. But don't worry, we're here to help you resolve that discomfort.
That's a clip from Many Happy Returns Helpline by the provocative activist group The Yes Men. They've turned their sights on Vanguard, the world's largest investor in fossil fuels, launching this satirical campaign in the company's own branding. It's part of their Many Happy Returns Climate Adaptation Toolkit. Now, David, when we first heard about this campaign, we at first thought it was serious for maybe the first 30 seconds or so. Is that right?
Well, yeah, we got an email and it was like a pitch and it looked all official from Vanguard. It didn't quite smell right, I will say. And I had a sense that it was tongue in cheek and reached out and eventually had quite a good conversation with the progenitors of this very elaborate hoax. I thought it was a sort of early April Fool's Day. They spent, must have been months and months, developing a very comprehensive, if entirely fake, toolkit, as you said, for helping investors get over their climate anxiety, and particularly the anxiety of having their investments contributing to climate change while they might be gnashing their teeth, you know, about the coming catastrophe. So, the products are fake. The whole campaign is a hoax. The anxiety is real.
Yeah, no, so Vanguard is the $9 trillion asset manager, that's trillion with a T, that the climate activists have been taking a look at, especially since 2022 when they withdrew from the climate efforts, such as the Net Zero Asset Managers Alliance. And why do you think Vanguard was singled out by the Yes Men?
Well, we talked about BlackRock earlier in the show. Vanguard has sort of taken over as the chief bogeyman. Vanguard's famous actually for low cost index funds. It sort of changed the entire, you know, mutual fund industry, you know, decades ago. They say essentially that because of that, they're tracking the market. They don't really have leeway or purview to select, you know, individual stocks. They're basically tracking the S&P 500 or whatever the index happens to be. And so they pulled out of something called the Net Zero Asset Managers Association, one of the sort of groupings that formed at the one of the COP global climate summits a number of years ago in Glasgow, you know, on that basis that they didn't want to get the blowback from the folks who were concerned about, you know, such climate strategies in their asset managers, while they at the same time weren't able to deliver it on the other side because they were, from their point of view, hamstrung by this index strategy that they have. So Vanguard's been in the sights of the climate activists, and they decided to kind of, you know, play with the dynamics there, the psychological dynamics. With this toolkit, I think you played the hotline you can call, but there's also, they came up with a made up drug called Dissonex that's supposed to reduce the sort of cognitive dissonance, as it were, between your investments and your positions. They went on TV and they got a station in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania to go along with this, I think unwittingly. And a guy appears with essentially a giant fishbowl on his head, like a terrarium. And there's like plants growing in this fishbowl. And he's got this glass bowl in his head as a kind of personal climate resilience, you know, tool to keep you calm, even if the climate outside of this fishbowl is going to hell. And the TV anchors, I will say, ate it up. So, you know, it was kind of a spoof and kind of obviously funny, but maybe not that obvious to some.
Yeah. So, David, this is all well and good as a kind of a fun spoof campaign, but it's deadly serious as well. And how does this interact with, or how does this intersect with Impact Alpha's editorial coverage?
Yeah. Well, you know, I just want to say for the record, we are against misinformation and disinformation, and we labeled, you know, our story on this, even though we had some fun with it, but we labeled it clearly, and, you know, used words like, you know, fake, hoax, you know, spoof, fictitious, entirely made up. You know, just try to make clear that we were not blessing, you know, the confusing, you know, the issues any more than they are. But I do think there was at least a number of serious issues. One, as you say, is that this problem that Vanguard points out is a general problem, which is you've got, you know, everyone has got, or many people have money in 401ks and other kinds of IRAs and things like that. And they're invested, broadly speaking, in these kind of diversified index funds. And those funds invariably, even sometimes the fossil fuel free funds, have fossil fuel holdings. And that does, you know, or your bank, you know, whether, you know, your major bank that you have your checking account in, you know, is banking, you know, fuel projects or pipelines or what have you. So we're all kind of, you know, in this financial system, you know, for better or worse, and oftentimes, you know, either through inertia or choice, you know, your investments and your banking are in fact contributing at some level to climate change. And so there is that kind of anxiety. More sort of technically, this index question has always been very interesting to us because people think that these things are kind of, you know, descended from the heavens, you know, fully baked or something, and that index funds are just a thing that you have to deal with. But index funds are an innovation of their day, and there's ways to innovate on them. And you could have, you know, you could have certainly, you know, index funds that rebalance by the climate intensity of the earnings, for example. And then you would over time drive, you know, all these index fund holders, including the Vanguards and others, to lower carbon solutions just by tracking the passive index. So you wouldn't raise fees at all. You would just have a different way of, instead of having it market cap weighted, where the biggest companies are the biggest share of the index funds, you'd have the, you know, the best climate and best, you know, best carbon performers be the biggest share of the index fund. So none of the, you know, these things are not, you know, the fact that there's index funds is not really an excuse. You know, we say, you know, change the index, change the market. So we think there's a number of sort of things that got surfaced or illuminated by this hoax that were of interest to Impact Alpha readers. And hopefully Vanguard can take the joke and maybe even think about it a little bit.
And I guess we should also clarify that Vanguard did not respond to an email asking for comment from Impact Alpha.
They have not. And I've been tracking, you know, the coverage subsequently. They don't seem to have responded at all. There were several websites that the group had secured to promote the campaign, and they got taken down quite quickly. So somebody's watching.
Well, and didn't the Yes Men also get somebody to attend this week's Wall Street Green Summit?
Yes, and in fact, appeared there, and somebody came out again with a fishbowl on their head. At which point, I think most of the attendees thought that they realized that something was up. But when they were initially invited or talked their way into the summit, they talked a good game, and they came on as, you know, as Vanguard. Purported, as I said, Vanguard officials before the organizers knew about it. And Peter Fusaro, who organized that, said, you know, quote, "We got punked."
All right. Well, maybe we all should take a Dissonex to help us with our own cognitive dissonance.
There's a fake peer-reviewed article that attests to its effectiveness. So, yeah, go ahead.
All right, well, we'll leave it there, David. Thanks so much for talking with us. Look forward to talking to you every week for This Week in Impact. And also look forward to your new interview show coming out next week as well. Tell us a little bit about that.
Agents of Impact, folks who read Impact Alpha know that we like to highlight folks who are kind of at the leading edge of ideas and structures and moving capital. Sherelle Dorsey and I are talking to as many folks as we can, and we'll bring some of them to you on this interview show kicking off next week. So we're looking forward to that.
Look for that in your feed. All right. Thanks so much, David.
Thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure.
And thank you for listening to This Week in Impact. If you liked what you heard, please be sure to subscribe to this podcast and share it with a friend or colleague. And if you really want to help out, please be sure to rate us and give us a review on Apple Podcasts. Believe it or not, it really helps other people find the show. This Week in Impact is a production of Impact Alpha, bringing you investment news for a sustainable edge. For more exclusive stories about the world of impact investing and sustainable finance, join other agents of impact yourself by subscribing to Impact Alpha. Just go to impactalpha.com/subscribe for full access. Thanks to our producer extraordinaire, Isaac Silk. I'm Brian Walsh, and we'll see you next week for more Impact.